Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to my session. Using a load balancer in your Microsoft Exchange Server 2010 environment. I'm glad you came to my session. I'm going to tell a bit about load balancing, hardware load balancing in general. I'm going to do some demonstration. I'm going to explain a bit more about load balancing in general. A little slide about me. My name is Jaap Beselius. I noticed quite a lot of you know me from the internet because of my blogs, of my tweets, or I've created some videos on msexchange.org. I've also written a book, Exchange 2010 SP1, A Practical Approach. It's a pretty small book, 250 pages, actually small enough to read it. And some parts of my book are also published on the TechNet magazine. I'm a contributor of the blogs msexchange.org, simpletalk.com, of course my own site, jaapbeselius.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at jaapwes. The agenda of today. I'm going to start with a small introduction. I have some load balancing essentials, and then I go to Exchange 2010 and what it means for load balancing. I'm going to talk a bit about hardware load balancing resources, and I end with a summary. I've been trying to lighten up this presentation. I'm not a static presenter. I cannot just stand here and read through the bullets. I always walk around. I prefer to walk around down there and back up and try to keep everybody awake. This is a lousy time slot just after lunch. Everybody falls asleep. Now, I can help you. I can start talking like this and everybody falls asleep. And after 75 minutes, hey, great session. Fill out the eval. I'm fine. I found a much better way to keep you awake. I have three business cards here. And the business cards of John Spears, Senior Director, Strategic Alliances and Partnerships. And John is somewhere in the back. He should be. John? He went away. He fell asleep, yeah. He's working for Kemp, and Kemp is a load balancing vendor. Each business card represents one full-fledged VLM 1000 load balancer. I'm going to give them away in the next 75 minutes. You fall asleep, you don't get a license. You ask stupid questions, I give the right answer, I look good, you get a license. Now for the most serious part, the introduction. Why do you want to load balance Exchange 2010? Or why do you want to load balance in general? It's all about redundancy and scalability. Maybe you want better performance. You can build a bigger box. But bigger box goes down, all your users start complaining because they lose connectivity. So you want to add multiple Exchange servers to your environment. Multiple Exchange servers mean you scale out, add more servers. For scalability and recovery, if one server fails, if all goes well, there are plenty of other servers who can take over. So your users, maybe they notice, maybe they won't. So it's all about redundancy and scalability. That's why you want to load balance. There are multiple ways of load balancing your Exchange environment. And in the past, we had Windows Load Balancing Services, WLBS, which appeared in NT4, and NT4 was somewhere in the 90s. It was renamed to Network Load Balancing in Windows 2000, and it's still available in Windows 2008 R2. And heck, it's even available in Windows Server 2012, as I was told. But in the NT4 timeframe, life was simple. We had just one Exchange server, and that's it. So there was not much to load balance. There was some static websites you want to load balance, but it's not a big deal. In 2000, 2003, things changed a little bit, and we get multiple servers. We get the front end, and we get the back end architecture. We even had some ISPs running Exchange 2003 hosting millions and millions of POP3 mailboxes, and they wanted to load balance. NLB is configured as a service on your Windows or your client access server. And it's a service, it's part of Windows, and therefore it's free. It's running in unicast mode, i.e. one network interface, or you can use a multicast mode, and it works fine. But there are a couple of drawbacks in NLB. When you use multicast, for example, your server is going to play around with the MAC address of your network interface. And you've got multiple servers, and they share the same MAC address, and it can cause port or switch flooding on your switch. Also, the scalability, when you want to use more than 8 nodes, can be an issue with NLB. It's not service aware. And what does that mean? Suppose I have an Exchange server running SMTP, a hub transport server, client access server serving HTTPS. The server can be fine. All other servers think, OK, this server is running fine, so no issues. But actually, the SMTP service may have stopped. And NLB won't notice that. It keeps continuing servicing. And yeah, clients try to set up a connection to this particular server, and it's not responding. So it's not service aware. When it comes to persistence, the only options you have here is to use source IP. And I'll get back to that later on, what persistence actually is. And important, it cannot be combined with a database availability group. Now, Microsoft is moving a bit from, or shifting from, using dedicated servers, dedicated cache, dedicated hub, dedicated mailbox server, to a multi-role server. You have one big box, you install cache, hub, transport on one box. When you go to this link, you can read more information about this recommendation. But you have this database availability group, and the DAG is running on top of failover clustering. And failover clustering bits cannot be combined with NLB bits on the same box. So that's a bit of an issue. And at TechEd 2010 in Berlin, there was a session by Ross Smith IV, and he was doing a session on Outlook and Client Access Server. And suddenly, out of the blue, there was a small bullet saying, Microsoft is recommending hardware load balancer. And it appeared just like that. And small bullet, large impact. What does that mean to NLB? Is it still supported? Most people, or quite a lot of people, think that when with the recommendation to use hardware load balancer, NLB is no longer supported. But that's absolutely not the case. If you can live with the drawbacks and you don't mind about the drawbacks in NLB, you're absolutely fine and supported running NLB. And there are also quite a few customers, and I have some large customers as well, running NLB. And one of my customers, who is a large hospital in the Netherlands, has 16,000 mailboxes running NLB, 6 cache servers, no issues whatsoever. The hardware load balancers. These are actually the way to go. And in the past, hardware load balancers were large boxes, very expensive. You had to have deep pockets because of the high pricing. But nowadays, price is getting much better. And it's not always about big boxes, high prices. But they're always also very affordable hardware load balancers. The load balancer, hardware load balancers are also referred to as the application delivery controller. And instead of NLB, where NLB is running on the client access server, it's a separate node in the network. And this separate node is independent of Windows, and it can do some smart load distribution, much more than NLB can do. It's also service aware, so the load balancer is monitoring the client access server for the particular servers. So we have a couple of servers, SMTP is running or HTTPS is running, and the load balancer is checking if the service is still running. There are multiple persistence options. Not only do we have source IP, but we can also do some interesting stuff in the HTTP stream, for example. We can do SSL offloading. We have some compression options. We can do some caching of OWASP attachments, and for the more expensive one, we can do packet shaping, packet stream modification, all kinds of interesting stuff. But the more stuff you want, the more expensive the box gets, of course. The takeaway of this part of part one of my presentation is that you want to load balance Exchange for scalability and recovery. Microsoft recommends hardware load balancer, but NLB is still supported. And if you can live with the drawbacks, you're absolutely fine. If you want to implement a hardware load balancer, there are some essentials you have to be aware of. The setup of the hardware load balancer. The hardware load balancer is an independent node in your network and can be connected using one network interface. It can also be connected using two network interfaces to your network, separate VLANs. These are called the one-arm versus two-arm setup configurations. Also important is the routing of your packets in your network through the load balancer. Are you going to use SourceNet? Are you going to use direct server return? Or are you going to use load balancer default gateway? I'll come back to this in the next slides. Also, persistence is important. We have various options. We can do some interesting stuff with the HTTP headers. We can do something with cookies, server-generated cookies, or load balancer-generated cookies. We can use source IP, just like NLB, or we can use SSL session ID. The distribution of the traffic is important. We have the load balancer, incoming connections, and the connections are distributed amongst various client access servers. We have, for example, round robin, where all the connections are spread across all the servers. Or we have leased connections, where the load balancer is checking the cache service to see, okay, which one is busy, which one is not, that one is not, can accept the connection. Very important, the load balancer virtual service. But I have to warn you, every vendor has a different naming convention. So that's a bit difficult. I called it the virtual service. And it's an instance running on a load balancer, running on the hardware load balancer. And this instance has its own fully qualified domain name, it has an IP address, and there's a port number attached to it. And this combination is also referred to as the virtual IP, or the VIP. And each service has its own settings for persistence, for distribution, timeout, or for SSL offloading. And a load balancer can have multiple virtual servers, so you can have one load balancer for Exchange, and you can create virtual services for HTTPS, for MAPI, for SMTP. You can even create multiple HTTPS virtual services. So back to the basic layout. I have a network here. In this network, there are clients coming from the internal network, from the internet, maybe from other sites in your network, and they are accessing the load balancer. And in this environment, I have three Exchange servers, Exchange 1, 2, and 3. If you look at this picture, is this a one or a two-arm configuration? I know him. He's not allowed to answer. One. Why? Okay. That's great. Who was that? Raise your hand. The one subnet. Come to the front, you get a card. There's one thing. I need your business card as well.
Everybody awake?
Wow. That's a pitfall I have been before. I better stay here in my own private space. Okay, by the end of the session, come up front. John will be here as well. We'll exchange the stuff. Two more to go. And remember, it's the VLM-1000. It's not the cheap one. It's the bigger box. So, but with all this noise going on, you will keep awake. No problem. And in these, this is a one-leg setup, which means the client is in the same subnet as the servers. So in this configuration, we have the subnet 10.10.0.0, we have the client, three servers, and we have the load balancer. And the virtual IP is configured in the same subnet as all the other machines. But this can cause some routing issues. An exchange should use the load balancer as the default gateway, for example. Or you have to configure SourceNet, or use direct server return. If we have a one-arm configuration and we're going to use SourceNet, this is what's going to happen. The client is not going to work. There we are. The client is going to send a request to the virtual IP of the load balancer. And the load balancer sees, OK, this is the client, and it's going to distribute the request, in this case, to server 2. The source IP, in this case, is 10.10.0.10. The server is going to respond to this IP address, i.e. the load balancer, and the load balancer will respond to the client. Two things. All the traffic is going through the load balancer. Now, if you have a well-sized load balancer, you're absolutely fine. Also important to note is that the source IP address of the request is the IP address of the load balancer. So if you check the log files on your Exchange server, you will only see one IP address, the IP address of the load balancer. This is going to happen when you use SourceNet. Another option is to use direct server return. The same client sets up a connection to the load balancer. The load balancer forwards the request to the Exchange server. And now, the Exchange server will respond directly to the client. And this is something the client is not going to expect. The client sends a request to number 11, and the response comes from number 2. So the client might get confused. You have to do some reconfiguration here to get this working, because this can be a security breach, and the client is not aware of that. The client does not expect the IP address of the cache server. So some direct server return requirements. You use no network address translation, but you use routing. To prevent this issue, you have to create a loopback adapter on your client access server. And this loopback adapter should be configured with the virtual IP address of the load balancer. And layer 7 persistence is not supported. It's more complex than, for example, a SourceNet environment. Now we get back here. Okay. Normally, the load balancer is going to do all nice stuff for us, like persistence and routing. And persistence is not possible here. You set up a connection. You are connected to Exchange Server 2. And that's the only connection you have. If you lose the connection for whatever reason, you have to go back and set up a new connection. So this layer 7 transparency, where the load balancer is going to do all kinds of nice stuff, is not possible in this configuration. Not all traffic will go through the load balancer, though. You don't see this too much in an Exchange environment. But when you have streaming media applications, for example, you can set up a connection to the load balancer. You're forwarded to a media server. And then you set up a connection to this particular media server without burdening the load balancer. If you have a two-arm load balancer, your load balancer is configured with two network interfaces or connected to separate VLANs. And we have a server VLAN here in the bottom where the servers are connected, and we have a client VLAN where the clients are connected. And they are connecting again to this virtual IP address. So what happens here? The client sets up a connection. The connection is forwarded to the second exchange server in this situation. It's going to respond again and go back to the client. Again, just like with the source net in the one leg configuration, the IP address that's locked here on the exchange server is the IP address of the load balancer. Persistence, very important in an exchange environment. And persistence is the way a connection is set up and a connection is held between the client and a particular exchange server. Even when something happens on the client side or on the network, you want this connection to be available or re-established with a particular server. Especially for stateful connections. For example, OWA. OWA is a stateful connection. Now, suppose I have my laptop here, wireless connection here, and wireless here in this conference is kind of flaky, and I set up a connection to my exchange server. Now, if my wireless connection is flaky, I want to be re-established with the same server when the network comes back up. Otherwise, I can issues, I'm halfway creating a message, and the wireless is just unavailable for 2 seconds, my connection gets lost, set up a new connection with another server, and my email is gone. So that's not a good idea. Persistence is very important for Exchange Server. Persistence is something different than load distribution. Persistence is important when the connection is already set up. And to do this, we can use SSL session ID, for example. We have a client, and we have an exchange server. They set up an SSL connection. And what happens in the initial request that the client and the server negotiate a session ID. And this unique session ID can be used by the load balancer to identify the connection to a particular server. We can also use cookies. We can use server-based cookies. We can use load balancer-based cookies. And the load balancer can use these cookies to identify this particular connection. We can use source IP. The load balancer will check the source IP of the incoming connection and will always re-establish with a particular server. We also have hash persistence, sometimes referred to as super HTTPS, where the load balancer is going to do some funky stuff with header information in the inbound stream. Cookie and hash need SSL offload. Why? The gentleman in the blue shirt. What was the answer? That's true. Pick a business case, business card, and you'll get this one. I need your business card. Come here. You have a pen? I know this is so 90s. You have a pen here? Yes. Adam Barnett. There you go. Oh, sorry. Yeah, no business card, I'll take your pen. here it is. The gentleman was right. If you want to do some HTTP stuff like the cookies or the hash, the super HTTP, you need access to the actual header information. And when you use when you have an encrypted pipe from the client up until the Exchange server, you cannot inspect inside this information. So SSL offloading means smarter persistence options. And in the past, you could also see things like SSL is terminated at the load balancer and it will offload intensive processor utilization from the client access server. That is true somewhere, somehow. But nowadays, we have this huge servers with tremendous processor power. So when you have thousands of incoming connections and you want to do SSL encryption, decryption on your client access server, your processor utilization will rise maybe 2 or 5%. So that's no longer an issue. It's because of the smart packet inspection you want to do. If you want, you can do SSL, if your company requires so, from the load balancer again to the Exchange server. And sometimes you hear you can use a smaller encryption key to encrypt the traffic between the load balancer and the client access server. There are some changes coming up there. A colleague of mine made me aware of this yesterday, that if you want to use 512 bits signed SSL certificates, for example, somewhere in the near future, Windows is going to start declining them because they say, okay, this is not strong enough. No offloading means you only have source IP persistence or SSL session ID persistence. How do you implement SSL offloading on your Exchange server? It's quite a hassle. There's an excellent wiki page, how to configure SSL offloading in Exchange 2010. And I forgot to write down the URL. It's somewhere on my notes, but I forgot to add it to the slides. But basically what happens is, you have to add a registry key, a DWORD key, SSL offloaded in the OWA key, MS Exchange OWA key. Then you have to go to all the virtual directories and uncheck the SSL option. Then you have to go to Outlook Anywhere and uncheck in the Exchange Management Console. This is true for Service Pack 1 and Service Pack 2. If you still have RTM, I recommend to upgrade to SP1 or SP2. But if you, for whatever reason, need to stay on RTM, it's configured in the web.config file. Never, ever try changing this setting in SP1 or SP2 using the web.config. It will absolutely destroy stuff. Now, if you have multiple servers, you can also use PowerShell. You can use PowerShell for everything. And PowerShell is actually the basis for all management we can do in Windows and in Exchange. All management tools in Exchange are running on top of PowerShell. So we can create a small PowerShell file, set Outlook Anywhere, disable SSL. We can create the registry keys, we can import the web administration module, and we can check, uncheck all virtual directories. I will do a little demo in a while. Traffic patterns and load balancers. We have this Exchange servers, and we have clients. And clients can come from the internal network, Outlook clients, for example. They can come from other locations, other sites in our network. They can be proxied from other client access servers, or they can come from the internet. And from the internet, it can be OWA clients, can be Outlook Anywhere clients, can be ActiveSync clients. And ActiveSync clients, for example, have their own strange behavior. And a Windows client, Windows Phone 7, will behave differently than an iPhone, for example. And you have various mobile operators, and these mobile operators have different networks, and they can do some stuff to irritate us as well. So we have a client, an internal client, and he hits the load balancer, and his request is forwarded to the first client access server. And we got another one, connects to the load balancer, and this one is connected to the second client access server. Now we have an external client. He's coming somewhere from the internet. is using the reverse proxy, TMG or ISA or whatever. And it's going to the load balancer. But what actually happens is that the load balancer sees a request coming from 10.15.8.1. And it is forwarded to my load balancer. No, there it is. It is forwarded to the third client access server. So far, so good. We got another client coming in from externally. And again, its source IP is 10.15.8.1. Hey, the load balancer thinks, I know, I have to go there. And this is not a good idea. Suppose you have a broadband or a mobile provider. If you have a mobile provider, you don't know the external IP address. Mobile providers can use their own source net stuff. So they have their network. Your mobile device is connected to the network, and somewhere in their breakout point, they are using an IP address. And this can only be one or two or five, a few IP addresses. And this will certainly impact your load balancer because all these mobile clients only come from a few IP addresses. And the result will be that the client access server, in this case, CAS number 3, is overloaded. So you have to be aware of all the various network routing options in your network. Now, if you don't want to use a source IP for reasons like this, you have to use cookie-based persistent. So you have to do SSL offloading and do something with the HTTP. If you use, for example, leased connections, the other connections will be directed to 1 and 2. One of the things I had to mention, and I was pointed out several times, on slide number 1, if you have any questions, please leave them until the end of the presentation. You can use the microphone up front, and we can do some discussion. The key takeaways of this part. The transparency of your solution is key. It all comes to, do you want to lock your IP address of the client in the Exchange server, or do you want to use, or do you not mind to use the IP address of the load balancer? You have a one-arm or two-arm configuration. You have to be aware of the routing of your Exchange traffic, and persistence, the way connections are kept, are very important. Oh, wait. It's my screensaver. Yeah, there it is. When I have three Exchange servers, named Exchange Server 1, 2, and 3. And I have added number 3 yesterday, and I want to configure this. Unfortunately, I ruined my lab environment last week due to some power outages. So I'm actually doing this in my production environment. Now, I'm pretty safe here. I come from the Netherlands. It's 8 p.m. there, and we have a very important soccer match coming up in an hour. So everybody is at home, not caring about his email availability. So I'm pretty safe. And all my clients are back home. Nobody is here. And I have to re-deliver this session at Tech at Amsterdam next week. So most likely, a lot of my clients will be in this session. If I want to enable SSL offload on my client access server, I have to create this registry key. Now, most likely you have seen creating registry keys before. If not, I'm going to show it. It's like being in an airplane. Everybody in an airplane always thinks you don't know how to buckle up. Might be true if you haven't been in a car since 1945, but let's see, what was the key? Oh, wait, it's here. I wrote down this gentleman's name. I have some cheat sheets here because I don't know the SSL. Oh, Yeah, it's the wrong key. I give it a value of 1, and we're all set. Any questions? Good. Now we go to IIS Manager. And we have these virtual directories here. We have the default site. And we have all these virtual directories. We have the ECP, EWS, the Microsoft Server, ActiveSync, offline address book, the OAuth, and the PowerShell virtual directories. And we have to go through each virtual directory and set. There is OAuth. Here is OAuth. We go to SSL settings, and we have to uncheck require SSL. We have to do this for all virtual directories, and we have to do this for all Exchange servers, all client access servers. And most likely, you will forget one. It always happens to everybody. So I always recommend using a small PowerShell file. And you can use this PowerShell file. It's also available on the wiki to configure your server just in one click. I ran the script before this morning, so the key, I ran the script before, that's true, but I just created this key. And now it's going to do an IIS reset, and we're all up and running. These are the longest seconds in your life when you're standing here. Although I have to admit, the hour before the session started was also a bad hour. I'm looking forward the entire year up until the next decade. And the hour before the session, oh, so much regret. Where are we? Oh, yeah. We now have offloaded or enabled the SSL offloading. One of the things you also have to be aware of is the authentication, especially when you use a threat management gateway or an ISA server in your network, because they have some requirements for authentication. All your servers in your environment have to be configured the same way. If you don't, you will experience very erratic issues, very strange issues. Sometimes it works, sometimes it's not working. And we all know these issues are the worst to troubleshoot. If it's not working at all, I'm fine. We have some starting point to start troubleshooting. But it's working. And I come back for lunch, it's not working. It's waiting for a timeout for 90 seconds, and then it starts working. It's working for me, it's not working for my colleagues, stuff like this. Or an entire site can be working. An entire site can be working, and another site is not working. I experienced this a couple of weeks ago with a client, and we were implementing a hardware load balancer. And we had a site somewhere in Germany, and everybody was fine. And the entire site turned out to be routed to one particular client access server. And another site was routed to another server, and this server was misconfigured. Now, this is horrible. So you have to be aware of. It's going to set up a new connection because of the IIS reset. But you have to be aware of the authentication settings of your client access server as well. And PowerShell is extremely useful for this. You can also go to the Exchange Management Shell, but you have to click here, click here, click there, and you have OAuth and ECP. But the Exchange Web Services, for example, are not even available in the Exchange Management Shell. So it's always best to keep or to work with PowerShell. So this is part one, how to enable the Exchange server for SSL offload. The one. Now, what does it mean for load balancing? Exchange 2010, what does it mean for load balancing? Here we have a small setup. We have multiple exchange servers on the right. We have two load balances because you want multiple load balances for redundancy there as well. Otherwise, your load balance is a single point of failure. We have clients. We have MAPI clients on the internal network. We might have some application servers relaying SMTP messages or using POP3 for whatever reason. We might have edge transport servers in the organization. Now, edge transport servers and hub transport servers are connected using the edge subscription. And the edge subscription makes sure that the SMTP messages sent to the internet are routed to the edge transport service and then routed to the internet. And there's an automatic round-robin load balancing mechanism in the hub transport service and the edge transport service. So there's no need to route these SMTP messages through the firewall or through the load balancer. If you have inbound traffic, you can use multiple MX records to create a redundant solution. So when it comes to Edge, for example, or it comes to Edge, you can bypass the load balancers. Now, if you have an online solution, like Forefront Online, or Trend Micro, or Postini, or whatever solution, things are different. Because they do the anti-spam and the antivirus, and they deliver the SMTP messages to your exchange environment. But there's no automatic load balancer. So you have to deliver these messages to the load balancer, and the load balancer, in turn, will distribute the SMTP messages across the hub transport service. We also have external clients, ActiveSync clients, we have Outlook Web App clients, and we have Outlook Anywhere clients, and maybe we even have some POP3 and IMAP4 clients externally. But it has been a long time since I've seen them. Except for ISPs, that is. HTTPS, client protocols in Exchange 2010. HTTPS, MAPI, POP3, IMAP4, SMTP, and a little word on public folders. HTTPS is very broad. We see quite a lot of HTTPS traffic going on in an Exchange 2010 environment. If you have Exchange 2010, Exchange 2007, you have Outlook 2010, the client is using RPC connect to the mailbox, actually to the client access server. But at the same time, the same client uses HTTPS for AutoDiscover, for example, or for Exchange Web Services. And Exchange Web Services are extremely important because your out of office is set using Exchange Web Services. Free busy information is retrieved using web services. So and that's not only externally, that's also internally. So HTTPS traffic is extremely important for Outlook Web App, for the Exchange Control Panel, for Exchange Web Services, and for AutoDiscover, for offline address book distribution. So I have five different services, each having its own requirement for persistence. I have MAPI traffic. Outlook clients connecting directly to the client access server for retrieving mailbox information. POP3 and IMAP4 are relatively light protocols. I refer to them as the point-and-shoot protocol. You get in, get the information, and you're gone. I don't care about persistence. Who cares if I get to another server 20 minutes later? SMTP is different. I just explained when using edge transport server, the availability is going through the edge synchronization. Public folder information is not handled by client access server. What do I mean with that? Outlook clients are connecting the RPC client access server running on the client RPC client access service running on the cache server. And from there, the cache server has connections to the various mailbox servers. Public folder information is not going through the client access server, but public folder information is retrieved directly from the mailbox server. So the Outlook client sets up a connection to the CAS server and another connection to the mailbox server. It's not handled by CAS, and therefore it's not handled by your load balancer. Public folders have their own availability mechanism. If a public folder database is not available, your client will automatically be redirected to another public folder database if there is information stored there. And all the clients, all the services have different requirements when it comes to persistence. I have four here on the left-hand side where persistence is required. The RPC client access server, for example. Outlook Web App, the Exchange Control Panel, Exchange Web Service are stateful connections where we need persistence. So when you lose your wireless connection and it comes up again in a couple of seconds, the connection is re-established. For Outlook Anywhere, Active Sync, Address Book Service, and the Remote PowerShell, persistence is recommended, but not required. If you don't have any persistence, most likely you will see a performance impact somewhere on your client access servers. And persistence is not required for the offline address book, which are downloaded using bits, for example. Auto-discover, which is initiated at the startup of the client or every hour for a rediscovery of the environment, and POP3 and IMAP4. I want to spend a few words on the CAS array, client access server array. The CAS array is nothing more than a MAPI endpoint for clients. That's it. This is where Outlook clients connect to. This is what you see in your Outlook profile. You see your server, in this case, this example, outlook.veselius.local. This is my client access server array. And I have to configure my load balancer with a virtual IP or a service using this FQDN. And my Outlook clients will connect to this FQDN. And the RPC client access property lives on the mailbox database. And this is where Outlook is getting its information from. It's connected to a mailbox database. It sees the RPC client access server property, and it's using it in its profile. So you have to create a virtual service with the FQDN and the VIP on this load balancer. MAPI is a static and a dynamic protocol at the same time. It uses port 135. So it connects to the client access server on this port and is going to negotiate some port in the high range. One for RPC and one for address book. And this is something the network guys generally don't like. If you are using a firewall, it can be extremely difficult, especially to sell it to these guys. So the recommendation is to use static ports. One static port for RPC, one static port for the address book service. And again, you have to use registry keys to control this behavior. You create two registry keys, one for RPC, one for the address book, and you assign a port to it. MAPI is also a stateful session. We have the source IP, therefore, as the only persistence option. We only have source IP because it's just RPC traffic. There's no HTTPS at all. We're talking about MAPI here, not Outlook Anywhere. Outlook Anywhere is the RPC traffic encapsulated in the HTTP traffic. And we can do round-robin distribution. Why do you want round-robin distribution instead of, for example, leased connections? If you reboot the server and the server comes up again, it's going to accept connections, but it's still busy, still working on booting. The load balancer in turn thinks, hey, I have this fresh client access server. It's not having any connections. And it's going to blast 1,000 connections in there. And the client access server needs some time to recover from this impact. So leased connections can overboost the client access server after a reboot. Again, there's a wiki page on this. how to configure static RPC ports on an Exchange 2010 client access server using this URL. Now, this is a stinky registry key. The first one for RPC, it's over there in the MS Exchange RPC. You have to create a dword, name it TCP/IP, and assign the port number. The address book service, you go to this key, and you have to create a string instead of a dword. Now, they should hang the developer that designed this. One day you're going to make this mistake, and you are going to use a dword twice, and it's not going to work. So this is on the client access server. Don't forget the public folders. Public folders, again, are connecting directly to the mailbox server, bypassing the client access server and bypassing the load balancer. You can also use PowerShell to set the registry keys. And when you do this, just store them somewhere, and you won't make this mistake. You can also create a registry file, of course. Just import the reg file, and you're fine. Now, when it comes to Outlook Anywhere, persistence is recommended. Source IP can be used. But in Outlook 2010, there's an additional cookie, the Outlook session cookie, that can be used for persistence options. Outlook Anywhere is routed through the load balance to the client access server, and there the HTTP stream is connected. The RPC traffic is decapsulated, and it continues from there on the same server to the RPC proxy DLL on the client access server. So it does not use any MAPI virtual IP if you created one. So the HTTP stream ends on a particular cache server, and there the additional work is done. RPC in data, RPC out data is used for alignment. The client sets up two connections, one inbound, one outbound, for sending and receiving messages. And if you mix these up, it can happen that one connection gets lost. Scott Snow will be here next, right after this session with the tips and tricks session. And he has a particular slide what you can do to avoid this. Because, for example, what can happen is that you are connected to your mailbox. You can see you are online. You send the message, and the message stays in your outbox. And you can press F9, whatever you want. It's staying there. Most likely, one of these two connections are broken. OWA and ECP are also stateful sessions. Source IP can be used, but when you use SSL offload, you can also use the HTTP functions. Web services, again, stateful session. Cookie persistence is recommended. But some mobile clients also use web services, can have some issues with cookies. Windows phone clients, for example, are having clients. Also, SSL session ID, that's a typo, can be an issue. iPhone clients, for example, happen to renegotiate their SSL session ID frequently. So they are connected to the first client access server, and after some time they start renegotiating, there is a new session ID, and suddenly they're connected to the second or the third client access server. So you have to be aware of that. ActiveSync clients, persistence is recommended, not required, and you can use the authorization header used by the ActiveSync client for persistent options. And possible options can be the mobile operator that creates a limited set, or that uses a limited set of IP, so you can run into SourceNet issues, or the SSL session ID again. Now, the client access servers have several virtual directories. I already showed them OWA, ECP, and Microsoft Server, ActiveSync, and they all have their own settings when you have a load balanced configuration. The auto-discover server kernel URI, for example, that's a property on the client access server. You can only set it using the Exchange Management shell. Now, if you set this wrong, you will hit these horror certificate warnings, where you start your Outlook clients, and then immediately you get this pop-up. The certificate name does not match the whatever URL. You have to be aware of this. Also, the web service's internal NLB bypass URL should be set to the server FQDN instead of the NLB, or the load balancer array. Now, I have a small cheat sheet here using the virtual directories here, settings for the internal URL, for the external URL. And if you have additional sites without an internet connection, you should all set them to $null. Print this slide out, keep it safe somewhere in your Exchange, near your Exchange servers. The key takeaways of this part: think about the workload and their requirements if you want to implement hardware load balancers. Use static ports for MAPI, and depending on the vendor, use multiple services. You always have to check with the vendor. I happen to use some Microsoft recommendations, but every vendor has its own recommendations. KEMP has different recommendations than F5, and F5 is using different recommendations than A10 network, for example. Some vendors say, okay, you can use multiple servers, multiple virtual services. Others say you can create just one, and we can do some virtual directory inspection within this one virtual server. So you have to check with your vendor. Here we are again. I'm not biased. But I happen to have one. Which makes, I happen to have two. One virtual, one physical. And I'm going to show you a bit how to configure this. We have this, in this case, this is a virtual one. And I'm logged on using HTTPS, and I'm on the management interface. And here on the left, we have this menu when we can create virtual services. We have some statistics information. We have the real service. The real service are the actual Exchange servers, the client access servers. We have some rules and checking options, certificates, and some system configuration. Now, I have created, I have configured my third Exchange server to use SSL offload. And now I'm going to create a rule for my load balancer. And I'm going to give it a virtual IP address, 192. To 50, for example. I'm going to say OK. Use port 443. Give it a name. Offload. And I'm going to add the service. I'm now created the virtual servers on this particular load balancer. And I have to set all options manually here. So I have to browse here, set the options for transparency, for persistence. I can say, OK, use source IP. I give it a timeout. I'm going to select round robin here. Another timeout, and I'm going to set the source net. I have a one leg configuration here. Now I'm going to enable. This is a bit of a crampy interface on how to set the SSL certificate. I'm going to edit. First, I give it a name. I say, okay, Exchange. Import the certificate. And here I can actually import the file. Oh, here it is. Okay, it's successfully imported. And the last step is I have to connect the certificate to the virtual service. I'm going to modify again some advanced properties I can set if I want to. And I'm going to add the real server. I'm going to connect on port 80. I'm going to check for the OWASP virtual directory. And I'm going to add my virtual server. And now I can check the virtual server, and I'll see I have connected it. It's up and running. It will automatically check my client access server, and it will show up as up. When there's something wrong in the configuration, it will be red, and it will show down. Now, if I want to create multiple virtual services, I can use templates. And templates are predefined files by every vendor, and it contains all necessary information. So, for example, when I want to create a MAPI rule, I'm going to use a star here. And I can select MAPI here. And what it will do now, it will use this template and pre-configure all recommendations, or CAMP recommendations in this case, in my configuration. And the only thing I have to do now is add this particular server again. And we're up and running. So it's not like in the past anymore. This is quite easy. The most difficult part is when you have to sell this to your network department. We can see some statistics here. Now, this is my demo machine. When I go to another one, and I have created multiple virtual services, just out of curiosity. So I have created virtual services for OAuth, for ECP, for Active Sync, for AutoDiscover, all kinds of rules that I have created here. The downside is you need multiple FQDNs and you need multiple IP addresses, of course. And you can use the statistics to see how the various virtual services are actually doing. You see the virtual machines here, you see the IP address, you see the real service, and if one server fails on a particular virtual directory, you see it immediately here and you can react on that. And by using multiple virtual services, you are more flexible in your deployment. Now, when I can go here. Can log on. We have this question mark here, and when I click about, I can see more information on this particular connection. I can see my host name, I can see the client access server I'm currently connected to, so I know I'm currently connected to Exchange Server 2. And my mailbox is on Exchange Server 1. Okay, I'm going to sign out. Going to set up another connection. And again, go to the question mark about. And you'll see this time I'm connected to Exchange Server 1. So it's using this round-robin mechanism to distribute all the incoming connections. Now, in case you say, but how about this persistent stuff? I normally finish the connections. I logged off, I closed the browser, so the session, my previous session, is officially finished, and I'm setting up a new connection, therefore, to another server. So you see here how to set up or how to configure, in this case, your CAMP load balancer. It's not a big deal to configure it, and how to check if it's actually working. Here it is. So some load balancing resources and vendors. Again, a wiki page, 2010 client access array load balancing resources. It contains TechNet videos, articles, vendor documentation, load balancer sizing tools, and it has some information about the load balancer qualification program. The load balancer qualification program, however, is not a certification program or a logo program. It's just something a vendor can apply for, and it's just about having enterprise class products, having the right documentation, having quick start guides, having tested for Exchange 2010 certain tests. That's about it. So it's not a certification, it's just qualifications, less strict. There are several load balancing vendors, hardware load balancing vendors. F5 is, I think, the most famous one, A10 Networks, Chem Technologies. There are a lot more offering these hardware load balancers, ranging from interesting, reasonably priced to extremely expensive. But a load balancer is nothing more than just a software application, so they are also available as software solutions, running in a virtual machine, Hyper-V virtual machine, or a VMware virtual machine. And these are the official software load balancer vendors. So the summary, the hard balancer solution is recommended by Microsoft, but again, NLB can still be used without any issues. You have to think about the workload in Exchange, and important aspects are the transparency, the routing, and the persistence. But again, check with your vendor for the best solution. Additional resources, load balancing deployment, wiki, CAS load balancing. These are the well-known slides, team blocks, etc. In September, we have the Exchange conference. 3 days, all Exchange only, with all kinds of sessions. Unfortunately, there are no Exchange 15 sessions here, there will be Exchange 15 sessions there at the Exchange conference. Some more resources. Complete the eval, enter to win, the MS tag, and that's it. Any questions? Yes. Don't go away. I'm still discussing that with Greg Taylor from Microsoft. Okay.
What's the why is that the recommendation to set the internal OWA server?
The load balancer takes care about the persistence. So you set up a connection to a particular server, and the connection is always set up this way. So I'm still discussing, okay, why do you want to do this? I will be blogging about this later on. Any more questions? I don't care is not the right word. I work with F5, I work with A10, I work with Kemp, and they all have their pros and their cons. I happen to have a few Kemp devices, and I think they are reasonably priced. The F5, for example, are extremely expensive, but they are so bloody good. So I don't really have a preference or a recommendation. I never go to customers and say, okay, you have to buy this or you have to buy that. Unless for the customers with the small pockets, they say, okay, maybe you have to focus on this. And can be Kemp. Over there. Yes? Can you use the microphone? Yes.
It's working. If you set the external URL in a multi-site environment, you would break the internal routing from external. Mm. That should normally be blank when you have a multi-site environment.
If I have a multi-site environment, it's null in the remote site, client access service in the remote site, to prevent it being routed somewhere else.
Yeah.
In this way, you can set up the proxy.
Yes, exactly. If you do this, you didn't mention the multi-site. You're only told that you had to set the external URL. But if you do that on the other sites, then it wouldn't route.
It will break, definitely.
Yeah.
So you should not do that.
That's right.
Over there, the gentleman with the cap. I can do another session, I'm afraid. I only have 3 minutes and 24 seconds left. you have to configure Kerberos, etc. additionally on your CAS array, for example. That's true. I didn't mention that. But that's right. That's one thing you have to do as well. Yes. No, I haven't worked with it. I know it exists. It's a layer 4, and it's officially not supported by Exchange because it's lacking these nice features. I haven't worked with it. One more question. No. Now I'm going. Who is going to win Netherlands-Germany game tonight? No ticket for you. What's your answer? Netherlands here. There you go. That, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. What did I hear? That's not true? I'm not so sure. Okay. Thanks for coming to my session.